Aloha, you're listening to Dolphinville Radio, www.dolphinville.com. Thanks for listening. I'm Dolphinus, and we're talking with Daniel McCullough, who is the premier dolphin photographer, somebody who has been on the trail for nearly 20 years now, laying down beautiful, sensitive photographs. You're one of the old-timers when it comes to people who have been involved directly with dolphin and whale consciousness. And you were brought into it and had a great deal of success with probably one of the most famous posters ever made of dolphins called Synchronicity. And it shows these wonderful dolphins jumping out in a pose that became a poster that was almost symbolic of an intelligent species. Daniel, welcome to Hawaii. Welcome to Kealakekua, overlooking Dolphinville here. We're still resonating with some of our experiences out on the ocean.
Yeah, it's really good to be here.
I want you to go take us back to the beginning. You said you knew Joan and Jean-Luc way back in the early 80s. Were you hip to John Lilly and his research even before then? Take us back to the beginning as to what got you interested in the whole idea of dolphins.
Yeah, I did know about John Lilly, hadn't read very much, but one of the very first connections that happened was having dinner with Chrissy Steffen, who is a very close friend of Tony Lilly, and more than John, but knew John too, and we went back to her place and sat down. She immediately grabbed a pencil and just scribbled out furiously two pages of automatic writing, and which was a message from I suppose it was the dolphins. I mean, they didn't identify themselves, but they were talking about the dolphins, saying that I was going to be doing some really important work with the dolphins, and get ready for it. And most of the two pages was about what I needed to do within myself to be ready to be with the dolphins. Such as
what time frame now are we talking about?
This must have been 1985.
Okay.
And it all had to do with my own inner healing and going beyond my fear, transmuting my fear into power and stuff like that. And then I had a flash thought, thinking, this is crazy. I mean, dolphins. I mean, I loved dolphins. I knew about them, but I had never paid attention. And they immediately said in their writing, well, we know that you think this may be crazy, but believe us, trust it, you know, and they were totally responding to my thoughts. So anyway, that was that, and then a year later I had an extremely potent, life-changing, lucid dream kundalini experience within a lucid dream, and basically it was about Santa Monica Bay. I saw it full of dolphins, tens of thousands of dolphins, the entire Santa Monica Bay. And I beckoned people into the water. I knew we had to merge with the dolphins, and nobody could see me. Very few people, like one or two people on the beach out of thousands, could see me or the dolphins. And they were two separate realities. So I stripped off. I went into the water, started swimming north towards Malibu, and with this feeling of anticipation of all these dolphins being behind me and coming towards me, but I knew I had to keep going straight north. And I became awake in that dream. It was extremely lucid, extremely potent, with this impending feeling, this feeling of impending crescendo that my intellect within the dream interpreted as being this mass of dolphins coming towards me, behind me, and they were going to all overtake me. But at the moment of crescendo, when I thought they were all going to go past me, they exploded through my spine, and I had just this full-blown kundalini experience. And I realized that this was the collective dolphin energy, literally, that just exploded right through me.
Wow.
And so that was really the beginning.
Yeah.
I mean, the automatic writing was definitely an indication and planting a seed. So I went looking for dolphins from then on, went to Maui, got a boat, got people together looking for dolphins, didn't see them. And somewhere, maybe 6 months after the dream, and this was the period when Jean-Luc and Joan were coming to Santa Monica once a year, maybe twice a year, and I, in my excitement about the dolphins, just magnetized myself right to them. And so I got to see them every time they did a presentation in Santa Monica, and we became friends like that. I loved their visits, and it was also helped me to plug deeper in. And then somebody, during that period, gave me a little round enameled pin, brooch, a round pin of two dolphins in a yin-yang, as a gift to me. They knew I loved dolphins. I hadn't seen a dolphin yet. And I pinned it to my camera strap and had it on my camera strap. Well, maybe 6 months later, I finally got invited to a film shoot that friends of mine were doing with dolphins. And I flew down to Florida and spent 2 days with these dolphins. And
Dolphin Research Center?
Dolphin Research Center.
The grassy knoll.
Grassy knoll. And, you know, with the grace of Mandy Rodriguez, the owner and director, I was there with them, and they left their shoot a day early. And I spent the next day that was reserved for the shoot, and therefore unscheduled,
right,
totally alone with all of those dolphins. But the first day was when they gave me Synchronicity. And it was just like they just stuck it in my camera. And I can barely take credit for it, except I was in Synchronicity with them.
Yes.
And that's what it was about. That's why it had to be Synchronicity. There was Synchronicity between them, there's Synchronicity between us, Synchronicity with the brooch on my camera strap, and everything. It was just, the whole universe just came into focus then.
You said this was about 6 months from the dream that this happened?
1 year from the dream.
One year.
Months from the dream, I got the pin on my camera strap.
All right.
Yeah, about a year after the dream. So that was 1987.
So Synchronicity is a word that's often associated with the dolphins, also spirituality. People have often said, for example, you know you're on your spiritual path and things are working when everything seems to synchronize in your life. So this was a real spiritual opening and expressway to the dolphins, starting with this one image that then became a world famous image. You said it provided an income for you for nearly 13 years.
Yeah, pretty much it took care of me, 12 or 13 years. Way more than all of the other posters combined and the licensing and stuff. And so it's been my, you know, extraordinary, magical, shamanic, even spiritual connection with the dolphins. This was their gift to me, and this was their link to me, and they're pulling me in to them again, back.
Back about that same time, though, weren't you invited to the first whale and dolphin conference? And where was that held, and what was that like?
During that time, as soon as I had, actually before the poster was out, but the image, I had the image printed up, a lady whose name I can't remember was scouting around the world for the dolphin conference, the first international dolphin and whale conference. And she was a friend of Kamala Hope Campbell's. And she was scouting around, telling people about it, gathering, you know, spreading the information. And she saw the image and flipped out and took it back to Kamala. And they made it the image for the conference, the first conference. And then, of course, invited me to be down there. So
it was in Australia then.
I'm sorry?
It was in Australia.
That was in Australia in Nambucca, which was Nambucca Head, I think it was called.
But be that as it may, a gathering of everybody who was the dolphin world at that time. I know that John Luke and Joan Ocean were there. John Lilly was there. Jim Nolman was there. Timothy Wiley was there. Who else do you remember who was at that first meeting?
Well, Horace Dobbs was
Horace
there.
Horace Dobbs, of course.
Betsy Smith, I think, was there, who pioneered the work with autistics. In Florida, there was
Estelle Myers.
Estelle Myers must have been there. That's where I met her. I'm not sure who else. I was in the audience. And I'd heard about Dexter Cade.
Right. Talk about Dexter Cade.
Well, this was wonderful because I was in the audience and it just got started, and I knew about Dexter Cade.
Tell us about Dexter Cade.
Well, Dexter Cade, not that I know a lot about him, but Dexter Cade, I knew that Dexter Cade had courageously gone to Japan, totally by himself, flew to Japan, went to Iki Island, and the night before, they were about to slaughter, I don't know how many dolphins, they were all penned in, captured but to be slaughtered the next day, he went in and cut the fences,
mm-hmm.
Or you know, whatever was enclosing them, and they busted him, they got him, and they put him in prison, and where he languished for a while until his brother Bruce Kate, who still lives on the island here on the Hilo side, went and managed to get him out and got him out. Wonderful affinity I've always felt with him. I had my yin yang poster, he had his yin yang dolphin ring, which I already had found and bought, which now is my wedding ring and my wife's wedding ring. And when we found each other, he called me his yin yang dolphin bro. But in the conference, he was there, the most humble guy in the world. Nobody knew he was there. And I asked him, I said, well, does anyone know you're here? And he said, oh, I don't think so. I don't know, you know. So I went to Kamala immediately and said, well, do you know who's here, you know? Mm-hmm. And nobody seems to know. And anyway, they dragged him on stage and applauded him.
Sure.
And so that was a wonderful meeting. There were all sorts of meetings like that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, humble, anonymous people who were just heroes in the cetacean struggle for cetacean survival.
Mm-hmm. Well, in that first meeting, I would assume that, you know, people had some outlines and goals for what they would like to accomplish, or what was the purpose of basically people coming together, sharing this information, sharing different kinds of information that they had gathered. Was there like a big enthusiasm out of that? I know Joan came back to Hawaii with John Luke. They began to do their programs over here. Jim Nolman went up to the Northwest and in the San Juan Islands, and he established a place at Friday Island, and so on and so forth. John Lilly, of course, who many consider the father of this whole movement. And we've talked to many of the programs, you know, going back to the 50s. John was kind of the initiator, and was initiated to bring in this higher level of consciousness. But I'm curious, back in 1988, I believe this was, this first conference, what was brought out then, and what do you see has developed or changed as a result of that, or the lives of those people? Have you followed them in your own life? How has that developed since that time?
Well, I think that I think there was an important gathering, because until then, you know, even though many of these people knew each other, but, you know, all of these people knew some of the other people.
Yeah.
You know, I'm sure.
Knew of them, yeah.
Knew of them, of the work. Yeah, many people knew of the other ones' works, but didn't know them. And I think that this was a time when, in a sense, a huge step was made into a collective human cetacean consciousness, or a cetacean human consciousness, in that these different elements, these different experiences that individuals had with cetaceans, all linked up with other ones, and everybody's experience became a part of everybody else's awareness. And so, my perception is that, you know, so birthed a level of true collective consciousness amongst the humans, similar to what I believe the dolphins are experiencing amongst themselves.
Okay, a pod mind.
Yeah, pod mind that is way greater than any of the parts, and yet all the parts contribute, of course, to the whole. And you know, I may be being a little too idealistic, but I believe that at least a lot of people maybe then incorporated the other people's experiences and allowed that to be okay, even though they hadn't had that experience themselves, and that it stretched each or many of the people's consciousnesses to include a much greater consciousness. There was dissension also. A little. There was some dissension, and
from jealousy, or
well, I think that there were different camps that I was aware of a little bit. You know, you had biologists and scientists, and then you had extreme metaphysicians, way out metaphysicians, and you had scientists who thought that some of the metaphysical people were way too out. You know, so there was judgment there, or some of the more intuitive metaphysical ones that felt that the scientists were a little too logical and left brain. So I was aware of some of that. You know, I'm sure that was true. You know, I'd love to know how Joan experienced the group, but so, you know, I was seeing some of that. But overall, I think a tremendous excitement and a tremendous feeling of going back out into the world, re-energized with a new dimension of enthusiasm mm-hmm. for continuing the work. You know, a deeper, you know, greater sense that this really is really important. You know, and that strides were being made. I think.
Well, people have been adding pieces to this holographic puzzle for some time now. Do you think it's been leading up to something? This collective consciousness. Do you think, as I feel, that it may indicate the next evolutionary step in human development to be able to live and appreciate living, such as the dolphins and whales are trying to show us? What do you think about that?
Well, I have two different, almost opposing experiences. You know, one is that, I think overall, being in the presence of dolphins and whales is going to bring up in humans everything that separates us from a unity consciousness, from an open shared heart space. Whatever people's trip is, whatever people's issues are going to be lit up. And I've seen people be really stuck in it. I've seen people be really adversarial, antagonistic, competitive, power tripping, you know, with their dolphin thing, you know, as opposed to other people's. And
why do you think that is?
Well, I think it's because it just lit up,
bringing their stuff up.
Mm-hmm. You know, whatever separates them from a unity consciousness or a shared heart, a real, truly shared heart space, that can allow for differences.
Got it.
In embracing of people's differences instead of feeling threatened by the differences. Which typically is a very male thing, I think. A male society, you know, humanity for a couple of thousand years or five maybe, has been, I think, very male-oriented. And, you know, if there were more women in government, I think that there'd be a lot more tolerance to the differences. I think women generally want to see the similarity between people or the elements that join us all more than those that separate us and fragment us. And I think a dolphin heart space and consciousness is actually more feminine in that way.
I agree with you.
You know, and so I think people are struggling with a lot of their conditioning in a male society.
Yeah, sure.
Stuff like that. On the other hand, though, I've seen a lot of people just bliss out. Total bliss out.
Yeah.
So I've always seen the total bliss cases. And, you know, and those other ones. So I think both have happened. I think they're both important. They're both valuable, actually.
Well, it seems like our society has been moving rather quickly towards adopting more of these so-called feminine perspectives into our, you know, interactions with one another. We've witnessed some very, very severe changes, you might say, in internal developments, the way people think about themselves in relationship to others. And you're not going to find this on CNN, or you're not going to find it on the mainstream media. However, in the position that I am and you are, where we're exposed to people who are working through these issues, and I've seen a lot of literature that backs this, not just from people who are involved with dolphins and whales, but we are part of this massive shifting of consciousness, the so-called paradigm shift, which is pulling us out of the male-dominated patriarchal point of view and allowing for a balanced, more perspective. Not that we're shifting into a matriarchal society, or not that we're allowing the female to take over our system of rule. More like we're trying to readjust within ourselves and balance these issues. The females need to balance their male issues. The males need to balance their female issues within themselves. I believe the dolphins and whales have been contributing to that, not only directly with those who have been exposed to it, but indirectly. You see them all the time in the media. They're used as goodwill symbols. They're used in movies. They're used in commercials. They're used as a way, because people have an immediate reaction when they see a whale or they see a dolphin. It's almost like you can't help but smile, certainly the children. You witness them, and even and I know you have quite an opinion about captive dolphin situations, and that seems to be a divided camp amongst people as well. John Lilly felt that without captive dolphins, we would know virtually nothing about the cetaceans, and there's something to be said for studying them and allowing people to interact with them in a captive situation. And I've seen over the years that situation. I've noticed myself changing. And I think Joan's perspective and others have shared that the dolphins that have put themselves in that situation are not victims. They are knowing exactly what they're doing, and they've become what we call service dolphins in order to raise the overall awareness and appreciation for this species. I know you've had some reactions to that. Being, you know, you take people out and have been taking people out for years, swimming with dolphins off the boats in the Bahamas. How did that get started?
Well, let me respond to some of what you were just saying first.
Because
there's a lot of stuff in there.
Okay.
You know, the one element that I didn't say about what I have experienced is the effect of the dolphins and the whales that just underlies everything and supersedes everything else is that universally they are tremendously uplifting and heart-opening. And I think pretty much must be said without exception, they open people's hearts. And they have done throughout history, throughout recorded history. And the ancient Greeks were just so involved and so reverent towards the dolphins, and ever since, of course. And so I think that's really important. And then, leading on to captivity that you were talking about, whether or not the dolphins literally chose to be in captivity and signed up for it, which may be the case, because I think that on a higher self level, you know, our destiny is self-governed, you know, ultimately. Whether or not that be the case, you're right. They are not victims. Whether or not it's because they chose to be in that role, or the fact that they are so spirited, they are so full of life, force, and heart, that even in captivity, even when suffering terribly, which they have obviously done, been, you know, suffering in chlorinated water where the eyes are so infected and inflamed they can't even open their eyes and stuff like that, you know, they still are devoted to making children smile, to bring joy to children, and, you know, in SeaWorld, even though they're suffering terribly. And in that, I feel they are a tremendous teacher for humanity, who, you know, often crumbles under, you know, very small events or you know, not so much pain. You know, will lead a human to you know, suffer, become neurotic, collapse, become violent or whatever. Whereas generally dolphins, even in that, you know, pain and in captivity, will still just you know, be devoted to.
So it's a noble animal.
Totally.
Showing us, you know, I agree. And, you know, the argument for and against the idea of any kind of captive animals. You know, we've been able to learn from them, and yet, you're right. I mean, there is, they're confined compared to their natural lives. This is unnatural. But what is happening is that, you know, what's been shown to me anyway over the last 50 or so years, the cetaceans have made a very conscious effort to get our attention. And this is one way that they've allowed, they've been able to get our attention through the entertainment venue. They've allowed themselves to be captured so that people will come and start to witness not only the visual splendor and power and grace, but, as we know now, the invisible sonar capabilities that come above the water and affect the hearts of the people who are being exposed to it. And something inside of me says that this is what's been happening. This has been part of their purpose. You know, gotta believe that.
Yeah, I think that's like the first rung on the ladder, and that we need to. that's a very basic level of what's going on, and I think it does have its purpose like that. What's tragic about it is, in my experience, dolphins are reduced in captivity. And that what people are actually experiencing of dolphins in captivity is not who they really are. You know, they're experiencing just a little slice.
Sure.
They're experiencing dolphins that are reduced down to what I consider to be actually a human level of adolescent emotionality. You know, they're reduced down into a codependency with the trainer that reduces their consciousness, their awareness, their emotionality, and their power and everything down to a very controlled space, and they can, you know, beam out from through that,
right.
But nobody's really actually experiencing the real fullness of who these dolphins really are.
When you go in the wild, of course, and we've both been exposed to that, and it's great when you have that opportunity. Not everybody has that opportunity, nor do they have the courage to get into the water with an ocean situation. We'll delve into that a little bit later.
Yeah.
Let's take a little bit of a break right now, and then we'll come back, and I want to talk more about some of the Greek history. I have a little bit of interest in that, and I think there's some fascinating things that we can learn now, some of the things that were on your website, which, by the way, if anybody's interested, I would encourage you to go and look at Daniel McCullough's website. It's called DelphinSynergy.com, and it shows his beautiful posters, his beautiful photography. Daniel promises to update it soon so that you'll see even more wonderful pictures. And when we come back, we'll delve into more of that. So hang in there. We'll be back in just a few minutes. You're listening to Dolphinville Radio. This is your host, Dolphinus. Welcome aboard. Dolphinville, talking with Daniel McCullough, who is a world-known photographer, who's been taking pictures of dolphins for, you know, over 20, almost 20 years now. And it's great to have you here, sharing your time and space. You came into with your family here a couple of weeks ago to just experience what it was like on the Big Island. Is this your first trip with your family to the Big Island? I know you've been here for a dolphin and whale conference 10 years ago.
Yeah, first trip with them, but not their first time with the dolphins. So
no, I guess not.
They've all been with me in the Bahamas with the spotted dolphins.
Yeah. Well, we'll get to the dolphins in the Bahamas because I want to learn about that. We were talking a little bit on the break here about some of the extraordinary people who have been involved. Again, sort of like the core group from this dolphin and, International Dolphin and Whale Conference. We mentioned a few names, and you wanted to make a commentary about some of these great visionary talents who were a part of that group. Please.
Yeah, you know, I think it's really important what each of these people is doing, you know, and what they're bringing in, the new paradigm that each one of them is describing or invoking or visioning.
Mm-hmm.
I think that there's room for whole new paradigms to be visioned and to be brought in. So Jean-Luc and his paintings are just the most fabulous things. I think my experience, I don't know whether he would agree with me, but my experience of them is some of that is existing reality, past reality even, and that some of it, he is creating new reality. And that some of the extraordinary blessing of real spiritual intelligence is the freedom to and the opportunity to create new reality, new paradigms of consciousness. And not so tangible to really know what that really means, but I think that Jean-Luc and some of these people are actually creating dimensions of new consciousness, and Joan and, you know, all sorts of people. And that it's really important for, you know, this Horace Dobbs, who knows that very few people are actually going to get out into the water and swim with the spotted dolphins. I mean, I think his experience has mostly been with the Bahamas spotted, and that he's creating dolphin senders and finding a way with audiovisual, you know, video and audio, and in meditation to bring that experience to the people, to bring the dolphins to the people, for them to open up, to be able to receive dolphins and have a dolphin experience, a real dolphin experience.
Right.
Which leads me to something else. I have always felt that dolphins and the whales, in a whole different way, the whales, navigate very consciously the astral and etheric planes, which to me are very tangible planes. And I'm assuming that most of the people here are familiar with
I would say that most of the people listening to this program will know what you're talking about and have accessed those to one degree or another. And have had experiences parallel. You know, it only makes sense that here the sentient species has been here for 40 or 50 million years in their present form, enormous brains. They've taken care of their initial needs of survival and food and social behavior. They must have a whole lot of time left over to go into these other states. We know that they don't sleep, that they are conscious breathers. So therefore, everything they do is in a state of consciousness that is reminded every time they take a breath. And that alone must dictate that they have access to areas of the mind, areas of other dimensional awarenesses that we are just now getting hints of, or the ancient philosophies have given us hints that they're there. The astral travelers of you know, the Eastern traditions, the out-of-body experiences of the more recent researches. So I do believe that those areas are entered through the heart space, because if you are clear with yourself in a heart center, then they will open up to you. Otherwise, they become nightmares. And I think this is why our society is so locked into itself, because we are fear-based reality systems have overlaid themselves so magnificently, because it is a consumer-oriented belief system. It's designed to create anxiety so that we need to consume in order to feed that anxiety. And so therefore never have time to even consider that we need nothing in order to expand into everything. These are the kinds of philosophies that have been put in the back drawers. And maybe as part of the threat, I think, on some level, that the dolphins and whales represent, why there's such resistance to having people and dolphins together. That may be part of the reason. Some, maybe not specifically, but just as we've seen in history, that any mind expansion practices, drugs or otherwise, have been frowned upon and literally outlawed in a short amount of time. And we're seeing evidence now that the government is feeling very uncomfortable about people being with dolphins in the wild. We talked about the wild being an entirely different experience to being with dolphins in captivity. And maybe there's a reason why that's been taken down to such a tiny little opening. As you said, the adolescent mind, it's been confined of what the dolphins are able to really express. Maybe because the humans aren't capable of receiving it in the in its full-blown variety. I don't know. I think it's kind of interesting what's been happening. And as we explore more of this, with technology now coming in, being able to provide, like Horace Dobbs is developing these centers with the idea in mind that we don't need to interrupt the dolphin behaviors, we don't need to inundate them with thousands of people wanting to have this wild experience. Instead, let's replicate that experience in these kinds of centers. Have you experienced any of these centers yourself?
No, actually I haven't. I haven't seen any of them. But I just love what he's doing, you know, with that. And that is opening up a new paradigm. That's opening up all of those people who cannot get to the dolphins but do experience his centers, for instance, and that's their main access. They're opening up that path, that channel to the dolphins. And I have no doubt that a lot of those people are going to start having lucid dreams where they know that a dolphin really came and connected with them. And that's what I meant by... I'm convinced that dolphins navigate the astral and etheric planes very powerfully and consciously, and connect with, I suppose, whoever is calling for them, mm-hmm. or available for them, any heart that is ready to open. I think the dolphins sense and feel very clearly people's heart space, people's emotional space, mm-hmm. As well as people's physical space. I mean, pathology in the body, mm-hmm. they respond to and even communicate mm-hmm. to that person about when they that person didn't even know it.
You had an interesting story or two about that. Can you share one of those anecdotal stories?
Well, there's one story that you know, a lot of people know about. There was, I think, at the Dolphin Research Center in the 80s, I think, this older woman who was stepping down into a pen at a you know, sort of spiritual growth dolphin interaction workshop. Mm-hmm. And she went into the pen, and this very gentle, beautiful, young female dolphin who'd never even been rough with her, and shot across the pen and just punched her in her lower ribs with her rostrum, which could very easily kill them. I mean, you know, it's
like kill sharks.
Yeah, they kill sharks like that. So, and didn't even break a rib, you know, but right over her lower ribs, it created very quickly a black, round, bullseye bruise right over her lower ribs. Winded her, they took her out, took her to the hospital, you know, they had to check up. And the surgeon came out with the x-rays and insisted that she immediately schedule an operation for Monday morning or something, because right behind that bullseye bruise was a terminal malignant tumor. It was really serious, I mean terminal, like it was mm-hmm. on her liver or something, mm-hmm. and that she didn't know about, and had, according to the doctor, no time to live. I mean, you know, there's no question about the fact that the dolphin saw it, acted intelligently to communicate what it saw, didn't even break a rib, mm-hmm. and got her to the hospital. And many stories of healings and mm-hmm. many people in the water with them experience being sewn out in different places. Mm-hmm. Very often a heart opening mm-hmm. experience. They just sewn out right into the heart mm-hmm. and they felt the heart being just exploded mm-hmm. open even.
Have you worked with the so-called dolphin-assisted therapy people in your work? Have you come and encountered them? These are people who literally take autistic children or kids with Down syndrome to greet and meet with the dolphins. There are some facilities in Florida besides the research center. Have you had any experiences with them?
Not directly. I knew Betsy Smith, mm-hmm. and over a period of years we were communicating, and she, I believe, pioneered all of the work with the autistics and started at the Dolphin Research Center. And then it got a little political and different things, and she moved on to Dolphins Plus,
right.
and had more freedom to do a different program. And then other people followed her, Dr. David Nathanson, and I'm not sure who else. Not directly. But I mean, she has in some of her videos. I mean, you don't even need to interpret it. There was one of her cases who was, I think, maybe a 15-year-old boy who had never put food to his own mouth, and she had him with the dolphins, and I think that was Dolphin Research Center. No, that was already Dolphins Plus. Mm-hmm. And you see this footage of the dolphin interacting with the boy who has his legs dangling in the water and sitting there, and pretty dysfunctional physically, and you can see that. But she gives the boy a sandwich, and he not only begins feeding himself, but feeds the sandwich to the dolphin. And so you see the dolphin receiving the sandwich and giving that boy an experience of totally being received, and then goes down and ditches the sandwich. He obviously didn't want the sandwich, and coming back, but making sure that the boy never got to see his sandwich being rejected.
Wow.
So things like that, mm-hmm. I mean, they're just mm-hmm. fabulous, that are testaments to the dolphins very consciously healing people, as they did me, mm-hmm. in different ways.
Well, can you elaborate on that when you say they healed you?
Yeah. I mean, my first experience basically was at the Dolphin Research Center at that time when I first saw dolphins that weekend. But on the next day, when I was alone with the dolphins, and I don't mind this far into the future admitting that I, in my prehensile nature, really wanted to touch the dolphin and stroke it. And this beautiful female dolphin would come around right in front of me, as I reached out, would snap at me, putting me into a tremendous fear. I mean, it just, you know, paralytic fear each time. But I was determined to do it. And I was determined not to believe that the act was actually hostile, but was triggering my fear, and it was for me to overcome my fear, or go through it, or transmute it, or whatever. And so it took about an hour when I finally managed to not let my fear reaction withdraw my hand, and I kept it going. I went right through it to this gaping mouth that could have ripped my arm right off, and continued to stroke her. And what I experienced was the most extraordinary laughter coming from this dolphin, and the most extraordinary joy inside me. And I just stroked her. She came around and around, and I just stroked all the way down. And then she rolled over, and it became on her belly. I would roll her. And I realized that she had managed to find a way to get me to overcome my fear, mm-hmm. or my doubt, my doubt that separated me from my heart, closed my heart, and just took me into a tremendous love space. Mm. You know, I was determined not to be governed by my fear and to stay in a separated space.
Mm.
And so I felt that she did that totally consciously.
That's a tremendous healing. Most of the people who come here to Hawaii to have some kind of an interaction through one or more of the seminars, often they have carrying with them a fear of water. And it's quite natural. Even if you're a swimmer, people say, oh, I can swim fine in a swimming pool, but something about the ocean, not being able to see the bottom, makes them very, very uneasy. And it occurred to me that there's a wonderful analogy between swimming into the deep ocean and meditating into deep spiritual space. And that the same kind of fear applies. People feel uncertain. They don't feel that, since they can't see anything, that something may come and snatch them. And one of the exercises that I help people to go through is to relax in this new atmosphere and to recognize that if they stop struggling, that they are naturally buoyant. And so overcoming their fear is much, much part of the issue. And I think the dolphins are there to demonstrate this idea of how we can start to liquefy our consciousness so that everything that was rigid, our belief systems, our fears that have made us like ice, can be melted into a very liquid, forgiving, and undulating, unifying atmosphere. Mm. And if you had to typify in a metaphorical way, what the dolphins and whales are presenting to us is this new way of feeling about ourselves in relationship to everything, a liquid way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I've experienced very graphically the extremely powerful effect that dolphins have on humans in dissolving their fear.
Mm-hmm.
And I had one woman on one of my trips who warned me before the trip. She said, listen, I am clinically aquaphobic, but I've got to come. And, you know, I told her that, you know, I should be able to accommodate that. I mean, she doesn't have to do anything she doesn't want to do, that, you know, she can just go as much as she wants, or not even stay on board or whatever. And that one trip, I had actually planned a day with captive dolphins in the Bahamas on the day before.
Mm.
The day before we went out,
sure,
way up onto the sandbanks. And I did this because I wanted to see whether I could help guide people into really feeling what a captive cetacean consciousness felt like, instead of like, wow, these dolphins are great, they're happy even in captivity or whatever, but to really feel the contrast between what they were like in captivity,
mm-hmm.
and what they were like in the wild. That was my experiment for myself. And this woman, everyone jumped in the water with these captive dolphins. There were three dolphins. Two just went off romping with the people. And this woman stayed on the deck, the wooden floating deck, which was about 6 inches above the water. And I was off to the side getting actually my camera ready, and I noticed that something was happening. She was on the deck, this one dolphin just totally stayed with her, and she was really just like rigid, clinging to the deck and could not get in the water, as she had said. This one dolphin, though, had picked her out, stayed at the end of this little jetty with its head above the water, just swaying gently, totally fixed his or her eyes on this woman, you know, making fixed eye contact with the woman, and swaying gently. And I thought, oh, something's going on here. So I sat and just watched. I waited. And I saw her body language just melt on the deck, mm-hmm. and it just kept swaying and swaying, and she relaxed. I saw her just kind of melt into the, where she was maybe 6 or 7 feet down along the jetty from the end. And she relaxed and started moving a little bit towards him and a little bit further until she was a few feet, maybe 3 feet from the end,
mm-hmm.
and just kept this eye contact. This dolphin kept this eye contact with her. I thought, oh my God, this is one of, he's totally taking the fear out of her. Sure. Her fear. And she came closer, and then he started moving back a little, but still swaying,
mm-hmm.
you know, side to side, and moving back, kept her locked in this eye contact until she put her feet in the water, and then she went into the water, and then he kept the eye contact, kept her in this safe, loving energy space, bubble, and she went, floated into the water with him. And he stayed there for a little while with her. And then, the next day, we were out in the ocean with, you know, in like 2 foot swells or something, with dolphins, and I was again getting my camera ready, and everyone was in the water, and I was about to get in, and I suddenly saw her way out from the boat in the wild ocean, couldn't even see land, and she had totally forgotten her fear that she'd had all her life of
wow.
water.
Wow.
And I've had, you know, I've seen many people just
mm-hmm.
immediately lose their fear,
mm-hmm.
even, in, you know, when they're with the dolphins. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of their attributes, is that they inspire us into maybe natural state of
mm-hmm.
fearlessness, of heartfulness.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, and when we're heartful, then I think we're fearless.
Yeah, no, I think there's an extraordinary thing there about, we're trying to develop what I call spiritual intelligence as a conscious society right now. Not everybody's ready for that, but I see the difference. What we're moving out of is these fear-based modalities. And everything that has been developed to lock us into these belief systems, because as I mentioned before, it develops into a consumer society, is being able to direct, their attention is being directed by these fear-based belief systems. And that's the biggest threat. If you no longer are afraid of the law, afraid of the man, afraid of this impending doom if you don't do something, then you pose a threat to the entire system, which is reliant upon you paying your taxes and going to work and working for the state and working for the government and working for the system to make it all hold up this big castle, this big structure. And I think that is really where we're moving into. Technologically, we've developed, and Bucky Fuller pointed this out over a quarter of a century ago, we already have the technology to feed the whole world. We already have enough power and food and resources to totally bathe, clothe the entire planet. But we're not doing that because that power rests in the hands of a very few people who want to totally monopolize it. If we open up our hearts and see how ridiculous that is, then that really threatens the powers that be. And this is the confrontation. This is the Armageddon that we're faced up with right now. And it's not good versus evil, because they obviously, you know, President Bush feels that he's a righteous man and that he's doing God's work and that he's doing the best he can with what he has to work with. And, you know, I don't want to run him down, but, you know, basically he's ripped apart all of the environmental laws. He's allowed the oil companies to come in and have, free reign. He's allowed the Navy to develop and deploy worldwide this, what we have shown, Ken Balcom and others have pointed out, is a lethal technology to cetaceans. And yet, part of me believes that this is all part of the unfolding scenario. That humans respond best when their backs are against the wall in the 11th hour and the hands are against their throat. And I think that's pretty much what we've backed ourselves into right now. And we're finding ways out. Part of the work that we're involved in is showing people that there is an escape route through the heart. And here is a sentient race besides humans who have proven that it's possible to live in harmony with this wonderful, magnificent planet without stepping over or disempowering others to do that. So
mm-hmm.
I'd like to think that that's what we're involved in.
Yeah. Well, that just reminds me that of what I've come to realize more and more, and that is the extraordinary grace and blessing even of this drama of polarity that is going on here. And in a way, the worse it gets, the better it gets.
Mm-hmm.
and that the shadow in some ways is the doorway to the light,
mm-hmm.
for now.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I would like to think that we're entering into, you know, the golden 1,000 years of peace and
mm-hmm.
whatever's
mm-hmm.
been predicted and all these different things, and you know, after 12/12 and
mm-hmm.
you know, the end of time as we knew it before, there's an opportunity for, you know, just heaven on earth, you know, everything, you know, the whole thing. But in the meantime, I think that continuing on from, you know, discussion about fear, the more we have tyrannical leaders, in a sense, we could also, by adopting a shamanic approach to embracing the shadow, realize that the worse it gets, the better it can get, and that these you know, the greater the fear that is stimulated by tyrannical leaders,
mm-hmm.
the greater the opportunity for us to go beyond the fear,
yeah.
and that we can turn fear into power.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And in a way, the more fear that is stimulated, the more we actually have available to us to empower that transformation. And so, I haven't got all the way there yet, but I'm heading towards a place of embracing the shadow, embracing anything that happens to me that is negative, not only as some kind of projection of my own out into the world, but that literally even it is a carefully engineered scenario to get me to go beyond my fear
mm-hmm.
or to get me to go beyond my prejudices or whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
And so the more people become afraid
mm-hmm.
by the politics, for instance, or disgusted by it, or outraged by it, which is very natural, you know, obviously to do at any killing that's going on. The more people are likely to go and be with the whales,
mm-hmm.
end up, you know, having an experience with some kind of a healing inflow of some kind, whether it's their higher self or doing a healing workshop or swimming with dolphins. And they're going to get that fear transmuted.
Mm-hmm.
My latest experience in that is suddenly, by chance, finding myself in an extremely dangerous situation with whales. And what I found happening was that I was in an extremely dangerous situation with males that, with any stretch of the imagination, would probably have to govern within themselves an enormous force of their fighting for a female
mm-hmm.
in order for me to survive the situation.
Mm-hmm.
And what I experienced was potentially a paralytic fear and possibly death, but rather went into that same trust as with that female dolphin.
Mm-hmm.
I used that. I know that. I have that template
mm-hmm.
in me
mm-hmm.
and went into just a total trust.
Mm-hmm.
It was totally okay.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel that in the midst of this enormous explosion of energy of this male, they could have wiped me out in a second,
mm-hmm.
that there was at the same time enough awareness by him of me
yeah.
that I was actually okay and safe.
Mm-hmm.
And that he swerved or something or made sure that I didn't get hurt.
Mm-hmm.
And that in itself was a tremendous awakening or transmutation of fear into love.
Mm-hmm.
And so my process continues with
yeah.
that. And then I am in more of a position to come back into the world and being deepened and more humbled
mm-hmm.
and more loving
mm-hmm.
and more available to pass that on to somebody else,
mm-hmm.
and
that's a great experience. Joan has also shared experiences when she's been with the whales in the Dominican Republic, for example, and they're coming within a few feet of her, and they have a pectoral fin which is 15 feet long, weighs about 4 or 5 tons, and it would, you know, if just being brushed by that could literally fracture every bone in your body. But she said through trust and just holding steady, in one case, one just gently lifted the pec right over her and back down the
mm-hmm.
other side, and totally aware, totally conscious, beings of everything around them. And even a little junior who, you know, is a playful pup, so to speak, that's 15 tons of rollicking flesh, somehow has the wherewithal that it hasn't, you know, the babies have come up to people down there and have been exposed. And even in the situations, we have to believe that, you know, we're being exposed to this so that, as you say, that we can start to experience something on another level. And we'll talk about that. We'll take a little break again and talk more about maybe what the difference between these rich experiences that you've shared with people over the years with the dolphins and how it may have been, in a way, preparing you for some of the rich experiences that you've just recently had with the whales. So I'd like to be able to share that with the audience. And we'll be back after just a few minutes of thinking about these things. Thanks for joining us here on Dolphinville Radio. And we'll be back with Daniel McCullough in just a bit. This is Dolphinville Radio, brought to you by Photon.net, your internet service provider. Dolphinville Radio, welcome. Dolphinville Radio here in the beautiful Hawaiian Kona Coast overlooking Kealakekua Bay, a sacred bay where discoveries have come for many, many generations. Captain Cook, the ancient Hawaiians, the whales and dolphins come here to play with humans, and they've been doing it for many, many, many generations. We're here sharing space with Daniel McCullough, a world-famous photographer. Daniel's website, dolphinsynergy.com, will take you to some of the wonderments. There's a whole page that he's got on his site called Dolphin Lore, and he explores some of the historical references that he's been able to pick out. There's many, many, many stories out there, but some of them are quite interesting. Maybe you'd like to share some of the ancient stories of fishermen and sailors and people being rescued, going back to the Greeks. We were talking about the Greeks. What's one of the more interesting ones that sticks out in your mind from the Greek mythologies?
You know, what strikes me, has always struck me as being just totally amazing is Oppian of Cilicia, who, and I think it was around 2,000 years ago, maybe 200 AD, when he very clearly spoke about the dolphins having been land mammals and going into the sea. He said that the dolphins lived on the land with mortals and then exchanged the land for the sea and took on the form of fishes. That was his words, or the translation of his words. And to this day, meaning his day, 2,000 years ago, paraphrasing, basically held the height of consciousness, the righteous acts and deeds of man, holding them for us, you know, waiting for us to wake up, you know, and to give us back, you know, or remind us, you know, back into the heights of our consciousness. And what's amazing about that is that we only now know that dolphins went from the land to the sea 50 to 60 million years ago. So how he knew that 2,000 years ago is, you know, amazing mystery and very exciting. And the fact that the Greeks really understood that the dolphins were holding a very high consciousness for man, and that they were the ones that held it, not us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they were holding it for us.
Mm-hmm.
And so things like that. You've got the Dogon tribe who were deeply involved with the dolphins and knew about Sirius A, Sirius B, knew that it was what we call a white dwarf.
Mm-hmm.
They called it the little white star.
Mm-hmm.
I think they knew its cyclical rotation. It disappears for a lot of the time, cannot be seen, and then comes back out.
Mm-hmm.
And
mythology had that there was a species that descended from Sirius who were part dolphin, part man. Was that correct?
Right. I don't know too much of that story, but yeah, that's another one. There's been a lot of interaction between man and dolphin, and notions that of dolphin men, human dolphins or dolphin humans, in the Amazon. There are different versions of the Boto story. I mean, the Portuguese Brazilians, as much as the indigenous Indians, have their own versions of those stories. And
the story, by the way, is that they come out of the river to make love to the women. Is that the one, the story you're referring to? The pink dolphins, the dolphins come out of the river, assume physical form, or at least enough so that they can walk, and entrance a young maiden and make love and impregnate her with dolphin babies.
Right, human dolphin babies.
Yes.
And so I think the essential element to those stories is this notion of the aquatic human.
Mm-hmm.
And that's like a really major element that's been missing in contemporary history and biology.
Mm-hmm.
Even. And there are a lot of there's a lot of evidence that we were aquatic mammals.
Mm-hmm.
We have traits that only we share with aquatic mammals.
Mm-hmm.
Subcutaneous fat or blubber,
yeah,
is something we share with aquatic mammals that primates do not have.
Mm-hmm.
They store their fat around their organs and internally, but not subcutaneously. And they also do not have tear glands, but the cetaceans do. There are a lot of different traits that we have that clearly show us to be aquatic mammals. But going back to the history, there are many accounts of the dolphins' extraordinary compassion and love for humans. The Greek poet Arion, in either 280 or BC, I can't quite remember, recounts how he himself, after being captured by pirates and then made to walk the plank in shark-infested waters, lived to tell the story because a dolphin came and fended off the sharks, literally, while he got to shore and saved his life. And he wrote about it. And all the way through history, we have these stories of humans being saved by dolphins.
Mm-hmm.
And then you the Greeks again. Apparently, consciously formulated their very refined structure of democracy on what they perceived to be the social structure of the dolphins.
That's interesting.
Including an analysis of the balance between discipline and freedom that they perceived within the dolphins, an appropriate amount of discipline and only where it was necessary. Otherwise, total freedom in the other realms.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think historians today, still consider that ancient Athens, around between 2,000 and 2,500 years gone, not sure exactly, really embodied the purest form of democracy that we've ever known. Very far from this representational democracy that we have here, which, is very available for all sorts of corruptions and permutations.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And you say that they adapted that from what they observed from the dolphin societies. So they already recognized the dolphins as having societies 2,500 years ago, which is kind of extraordinary. We talked a little bit about Delphi. Delphi is dolphin. It also means womb in Greek. and it represented this center, the religious center, the Mecca, the strongest, most powerful religious center of the ancient world. It was an ancient center prior to it becoming Delphi. It was known as Pythia, and it had the Pythians there, and the Pythias were the women who were enslaved by the ensuing armies or marauding armies that were associated with the god Apollo, who brought in the laws and put everything in place. And we know historically that this small little center of religious temple society was converted into this Las Vegas of the spiritual world. And all the wealthy businessmen from the ancient Greece and the Mediterranean would come with their offerings and their riches. And if you've ever been, I went to the remains of Delphi, and it's a winding serpentine pathway up to this grand temple in which you make donations at various places along the way. And if your donations are appropriate enough, and you've greased the palms of enough of the priests, then you might get an audience with the oracle who is up at the top of the hill. So it became a money-making enterprise. And I wonder if this was part of the underlying corruption of what was given, perhaps laid on this ancient society by the Cetaceans, and then withdrawn as that particular information was corrupted.
So one of the part of the stage of the consciousness, the evolution of our consciousness has been this male dominance of the feminine, and the logical over the intuitive, the mind over the heart, and I think mind intrinsically does not contain any wisdom. I think mind is mechanical and pragmatic, and you know, intrinsically is there to implement and manifest the real source of wisdom, mm-hmm. which is more the right brain and the feminine, I believe. Not that men have no wisdom and women do, but mm-hmm. we all contain both. But I think the logical mind in itself, which can develop a life of its own and want to survive itself, the ego can, you know, no longer become in service to the soul and to implement the soul, but takes on a life of its own, mm-hmm. and out of its own need or desire for survival, takes on a life of its own, and then embarks on separation, antagonism, mm-hmm. and you know, a whole lot of very destructive tendencies once it has dominated. And I think the male and the ego go hand in hand, where the male side gets out of control or out of being directed by the feminine wisdom or the intuitive and mm-hmm. spiritual and the heart space. And I think that's what we've seen for this last, whether it started in Babylon or whatever, 4,500 years ago, or whenever that whole thing has happened. And I think now it's time for the Cetaceans to, part of what's happening, I believe, is that the Cetaceans are reawakening the other side, the feminine.
Mm-hmm.
And not the feminine over the masculine, mm-hmm. but for the, you know, really to be, you know, mutually supportive and perfectly mm-hmm. Complementary to each other.
There was a story that came out about 10 years ago now by Ken Grimwood called Into the Deep that told a story of the Cetaceans coming back into the consciousness of humans because they recognized that the technology that humans were employing in the ocean was posing a severe risk to everything. And it's almost like art, reality following art. We have seen technologies that are being released into the oceans. LFAS is the best example, but other technologies that the oil companies are using, seismic technologies to check where the next oil deposit would be. Even suggestions that the sonar impact and exploding sonar guns that are used could affect fault lines and start earthquakes. It was even suggested that this most latest tsunami, which was set off by the major 9.1 or 9.0 earthquake, was somehow stimulated by technology. That's not been proven, and of course, even if it was true, it would never be shown. But I think that book points out that the Cetaceans may be coming back. It's been shown to me the last 50 years they've been consciously trying to get our attention so that we can start to come back into a frame of being, a state of awareness that is our birthright. We know that we're using but a fraction of our capabilities physically, mentally, spiritually, and this 10% that we've been allotted somehow has been locked in to place as some kind of governing mechanism so that we have not been able to expand beyond that. Our generation, which is the baby boomer generation, so anybody listening knows that we're in our 50s, and we've been able to experience this society different than all of the successive generations. We, for the first time after World War II, were given the luxury of not having to worry about survival needs. We were given freedom to explore ourselves and our friends. We were given money to be able to go out and experiment and do things. We ran right into hallucinogenic drugs and ways of expanding our minds through music and interaction. And so our generation has been bringing in large numbers of people and been bringing in a new sensibility. And I think this is what we're facing now. As we're coming to our elder, we're stepping into our elder roles and assuming a new responsibility for who we are in our culture, and hopefully bringing in this new level of awareness and wisdom. We're allowing this feminine aspect to come back into play, and I think the dolphins and the whales now are applauding this as we are now developing into it. I'm kind of excited. I'm glad I woke up, at least enough to be aware of myself in time and space.
Yeah, and with that, or to elaborate on that, I think it's interesting to note that with their extraordinary intelligence, that according to our own biological criteria for intelligence, i.e. the extent of a brain's convolutions in the cerebral cortex, the greater the ability to conceptualize with the greater amount of convolutions in the cerebral cortex. And according to those same criteria that we've already, defined, these dolphins that have been almost unchanged for 30 to 40 million years, it is obvious that there is some massive intelligence. Well, it's interesting to me, hopefully to other people, that with that extraordinary intelligence, huge, vast brain power, they chose to come into the water in which they could simplify their lifestyle to such an extent that survival took on, apparently people think, maybe 15% of their energy in their waking, waking time.
Right, their attention.
Which leaves them the rest of the time for extraordinary love play and mm-hmm. sexual activity, mm-hmm. which in itself, I think, is also our birthright, mm-hmm. and extremely inhibited in humanity, mostly, generally.
Yeah.
And that with, the amount of sexual movement,
mm-hmm.
That energy flows throughout their entire nervous system, including their brain, and activates their brain. This is the core of Tantra. I think mm-hmm. dolphins are the ultimate Tantra beings, true Tantra. And their sexual energy is channeled and flows and illuminates mm-hmm. their brain.
Procreation, by the way, another interesting thing besides humans, dolphins are the only other mammals that we know of that have sex for fun.
Except for one species of monkey that does. Only one species of monkey, and I can't remember the name. The 100th
monkey.
Yeah, probably the 100th monkey. It must be the 100th monkey. Not only have fun, but where the females have an orgasm,
uh-huh.
a real orgasm. Only humans, cetaceans, and this one monkey, apparently.
The 100th monkey.
The 100th monkey. But I think by virtue of having a very simple lifestyle,
mm-hmm.
I mean, where survival requires such a small amount of their energy, that allows the rest of the energy to flow in the most amazing ways that we can't even grasp yet, and we're just getting a glimpse into it. Man, on the other hand, partly due to political domination of the people, of the masses, whose philosophy has always been keep the masses divided, keep them impoverished, keep them on a treadmill so that they can't even get to it.
And sexually inhibited as well.
And sexually inhibited, right. And inhibited in all ways. Keep their consciousness inhibited, outlaw anything that, that expands their consciousness and you know, except for creativity in limited ways.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's another whole message from the, or, you know, a way that we can be inspired by mm-hmm. the cetaceans is back into that.
We touched upon whales just before the last break, and I want to get back to that only because it's been my experience with the dolphins, and then eventually about 4 years ago I had the experience of getting in the water with the dolphins, or excuse me, the whales in the Dominican Republic. From that moment forward, and it wasn't, it was a classic case of being able to swim eye to eye with a mother and a baby whale, a large humpback, something shifted within me. It was so intangible that I still am yet to find words. In fact, I'm reminded of a story that I had a conversation I had with Dr. John Lilly, who, by the way, had a model of a sperm whale's brain on his coffee table, which he proudly displayed as the largest brain on the planet, and the, you know, convoluted and looking like a human brain, but only the size of a bushel basket. But he, when trying to explain, when I asked him, I said, what was it like when he had this encounter, this very, very intense encounter with the whale, when he was actually took quite a bit of LSD and got into the water and had a face-to-face. And he looked at me and just sort of gave me a gaze and said nothing. But from that, a wave came to me as if it was an intuitive telepathic message to let me know that there was a space that was open within him that was so indescribable that you could not even get close to it with any form of words, action, deed, art, or anything else, but nonetheless was very tangible in and of itself. And when I had that similar experience, suddenly something opened up within me, and it occurred to me that the dolphins were there, had prepared me so beautifully in order to have this, have myself in a position where I could actually experience this. And now you've had just recently, after all these years of being with dolphins, had an experience with whales. How would you describe the difference between the experience with dolphins and those with whales?
Well, first I'd like to tell you the similarity.
Okay.
Which is sort of extraordinary. Now, looking and feeling back into my dolphin space and the space that I share with dolphins,
mm-hmm.
And the space that I feel the dolphins to be in, I experienced the whales holding a very the very similar traits, aspects to that the dolphins have on a vaster scale.
Mm-hmm.
One thing being this sense of a collective consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
And what that means to me is literally through the eye of whether it's the dolphin or the whale, I experienced this vast consciousness that I mean, so much vaster in the whales than the dolphins. In fact, okay, here's the difference then. One difference for me in the dolphins, when I first really engaged through their eye, I realized I was looking into a consciousness that connected to many other dolphins, if not all of the dolphins.
Mm-hmm.
I knew it was way bigger than that one dolphin, and I'm sure this to be true, although I have no way to really validate that. But anecdotal for now has got to do in all of our experiences with cetaceans,
mm-hmm.
or a lot of them. But I very clearly saw that I was connecting in to a very huge consciousness, if you like, similar to our higher self or our collective consciousness. I mean, our collective subconscious, if you like, in those terms, or possibly, or
superconscious.
But like the higher self or
mm-hmm.
the superconscious
mm-hmm.
that manifest through all of the individual dolphins. And it was very clear with the dolphins. I think with humans, mostly they're separated. There's a separation with their higher self or with the collective consciousness
mm-hmm.
or the superconscious. But with dolphins, they're all open and connected.
Mm-hmm.
What I experienced with the whales is that goes way beyond the species of whale or collectively all of the species of whales and becomes something almost universal. I mean, almost one with you know, the one that all it is,
mm-hmm.
or the the true total unity consciousness. Something like that is what I felt.
Right, to source.
To source, if you like, or yeah, you know, and you know, hey, God, maybe, or Goddess,
yeah,
or what, Gaia, you
know. Yeah,
yeah. I know, something very huge, and maybe for that reason, I felt really safe, even in the most dangerous situation, and connected to everything, and that if I died, somehow, not only would that be okay, but that if I died in that space, I would not experience a separation.
Mm-hmm.
I would just
melt
lose
in
the body, just you know, whatever, you know. And so there's some higher octave of the dolphins that I'm experiencing in the way. It's like
mm-hmm.
a higher octave, like they are the elders of all of the dolphins, even.
It was suggested by a channel by the name of Bashar that the whales are actually the physical oversouls of the dolphins.
Right.
Which
yeah.
It felt right to me when he said that. And that they contain within them a cellular memory of all that has ever come before. That's why they're so huge. Their cells are able to have the information that is the Akashic record, and that is the physical reality that they're holding in place. We talk about the etheric Akashic record being able to access all of the thoughts that have ever been thought on some level. But I believe that there has to be something that's grounding that, some resonant frequency that allows that to exist in a very physical way. And like that Star Trek movie that came out in, I think it was the early 80s, that showed that they had to go back in time to capture a humpback so that it would be brought to the future, because there was a space vehicle that was destined to destroy the Earth because it had made contact with the only intelligent species on the planet, which happened to be a humpback whale. And since it was coming back and the whale wasn't there, the story
mm-hmm.
that I'm sure most of the people in this audience have seen that movie.
Mm.
Where do you feel that this new sensibility is going to lead you, if you have that take now, or where do you think your work is going to be leading you now?
Well, there's several things that I want to do. Right now I'm working on a film that's very simple, but deeply invocative.
Mm-hmm.
And what I want to get is just dolphins to music. And what I want is for people to be in watching this, is to be so drawn in,
mm-hmm.
and for it to have such invocative power
mm-hmm.
of that dolphin consciousness that it infuses the person watching it.
Mm-hmm.
And very simple, but not so easy necessarily, but very deep.
Mm-hmm.
I also have spent time with dolphin elders.
What does that mean?
Well, literally, elders, very old members of
these are wild dolphins?
Wild spotted dolphins
mm-hmm.
in the Bahamas. I found a place. Normally people don't get to experience groups of elders. You know, they're usually one or two elders or a few maybe in a group, which people usually call, oh, you know, there was this pod today.
Mm-hmm.
But really it's just a small part of the larger pod.
Mm-hmm.
And their social groupings within the pod is very complex.
Mm-hmm.
But you rarely see large groups of elders. But I found myself amongst a very large group of elders, and it was an extremely potent situation. And two of them broke away, or at least most of them went on, and two stayed with me. And so ensued an ever-intensifying encounter with these dolphins that was closer and closer with me, getting more and more animated, spending more and more time vertical, watching me in front of the camera, and coming towards me, and even you could see conferring
mm-hmm.
amongst the two of them,
mm-hmm.
almost like they were talking to each other about me. You could see it very clearly until they come right in front of the camera and just start vocalizing, an extraordinary vocalization
mm-hmm.
into the camera. And I can only call this a message from the dolphin elders because that is exactly what it is.
Mm-hmm.
And so that is the second one that I'm going to embark on. I also want to, in collaboration, I'm sure, with others, do an epic feature
mm-hmm.
Because the subject matter is so epic, of the history of man's relationship with the dolphins.
Mm-hmm.
Not only going back to recorded history, such as the ancient Greeks, but pre-recorded history through either people from the time, Pliny the Elder,
mm-hmm.
You know, some of these Romans and Greeks that were in touch with the Egyptian, or Plato,
mm-hmm.
who recounts how his father had come back from Egyptian priestesses,
uh-huh, uh-huh.
who told him, Plato's father,
right.
about Atlantis,
mm-hmm.
and what had happened and the relationship between humans and dolphins in Atlantis. That's the only record that I'm aware of,
hmm.
you know, that links us to Atlantis,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
But to take all of the history that we can and put it into a documentary of man's relationship with the dolphins,
mm-hmm.
historically, and to revive some of the Greek wisdom that they got from the dolphins, and just revive everything that we've lost,
mm-hmm.
and bring it into the present, and then show the amazing things that humans are doing with dolphins, and the amazing transformation that has happened to humans while being in contact with all of the cetaceans,
mm-hmm.
dolphins and whales, and to document the new infusion from the cetaceans,
mm-hmm.
and hopefully persuade the rest of the world that under all accounts, I mean, there is no way that we can allow the cetaceans to decease,
mm-hmm.
And that they must be protected, and hopefully that man can go beyond his sense of or his limited anthropocentric projection onto the world, that intelligence is only intelligence as prehensile,
mm-hmm.
like himself,
right.
meaning that he manipulates matter,
mm-hmm.
with his hands,
mm-hmm.
And to see that there is intelligence that is non-prehensile.
Mm-hmm.
The cetaceans are non-prehensile, highly spiritual, highly telepathic, telepathic,
mm-hmm.
empathetically telepathic,
mm-hmm.
Intelligence that must be included in our own hierarchy,
mm-hmm.
and that I believe, as with John Lilly and many others, that they must be represented in our own forms, like the United Nations,
mm-hmm.
you know, really must take into account the other sentient species on the planet that actually, in my opinion, is the truly indigenous sentient species of this planet that is also who we are and have been.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a wonderful sentiment. I believe in the cetacean nation that John Lilly talked about, and I would love to see it recognized by the United Nations or whatever powers that be. More importantly, I also agree that if the human populace generally were to accept another sentient race of beings, that our whole cosmology would shift. Not only would we, it would tend to heal this wounded heart of feeling abandoned by the Creator, as being the only species that to have thought and have spirituality, but it would also open up perhaps an entire new realm of experiential awareness from which we can grow and learn and start to evolve into, or maybe revolve back into what we truly were at a time in ancient pre-recorded history. Perhaps ancient Lemuria is really just the dolphins and the whales, and we've only mythologized it as an ideal society that we was from a distant past. And maybe ancient Atlantis was the humans and dolphins living, working, and being together as one unified culture, and again been mythologized. And these are kind of exciting prospects. I look forward to working with you in the future. I know that we have some things to do. I'm looking forward to wherever that will pan out, Daniel. It's been wonderful getting to know you. It's been wonderful having you here in Dolphinville. Thank you for your time and sharing with us and in the audience. And we'll look forward to more future things. I think that you'll be back with some more fascinating stories about the projects and things that we'll be developing along the line. So I want to thank you for sharing it with us this time.
Oh, it's been a joy. And I'd like to just end with just a simple message that comes from a most remarkable woman and mermaid, human, dolphin,
mm-hmm.
Who's been spreading the aloha spirit and the dolphin spirit distilled into a phrase, Godliness is next to godliness.
Mm-hmm. And who's the woman?
And that's Lily Townsend.
Okay.
From Maui. Yeah, thank you. You know, so I love and adore Lily, and godliness is next to godliness, and hopefully we can all get that.
Yes. Well, thank you again. This is Douglas Dolphinus here in Dolphinville. Thank you for being with us. Remember, we'll be back for more of these explorational shows. In the meantime, be well and swim free. See ya next time.